And now, it's time for our weekly news round, Lutheran Radio News with Paul Hill.
Archaeologists digging at Jerusalem's Mount Zion have uncovered what they say is clear evidence of the devastation and destruction that occurred during the Babylonian conquest 2,600 years ago. At the site, a team led by researchers at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte found layers of burnt wood and ash along with pottery sherds, Scythian, arrowheads and gold jewellery in the style of the era. Given the location and nature of the artifacts found, the experts say the signs all point to the historical conquest. The announcement comes just weeks after the team revealed they'd uncovered evidence from the Siege of Jerusalem during the First Crusade. The discovery is the second significant find from the 2019 season of the Mount Zion archaeological project, the team says. We know where the ancient fortification line ran, so we know we are within the city, says UNC Charlotte Professor of History Shimon Gibson. We know that this is not some dumping area, but the southwestern neighbourhood of the Iron Age city. During the 8th century BC, the urban area extended from the City of David area to the southeast and as far as the Western Hill where we are digging. While there are other possible explanations to account for the discovery of an ashen layer, such as long ago garbage burning or the deposits from ovens, the researchers say the uniqueness of this find points to a Babylonian siege. In this case, the combination of an ashy layer full of artifacts mixed with arrowheads and a very special ornament indicates some kind of devastation and destruction, Gibson said. Nobody abandons golden jewellery and nobody has arrowheads in their domestic refuse. And the experts say these artifacts, particularly the Scythian-type bronze and iron arrowheads, all point to a particular period in history. The arrowheads are known as Scythian arrowheads and have been found at other archaeological conflict sites from the 7th and 6th centuries BC, Gibson said. They are known at sites outside of Israel as well. They were fairly commonplace in this period and are known to be used by the Babylonian warriors. Together, this evidence points to the historical conquest of the city by Babylon, because the only major destruction we have in Jerusalem for this period is the conquest of 587-586 BC. The team is slowly but surely working its way through the site and has yet to excavate the building associated with the newly discovered destruction layer. This will likely happen in the 2020 season, the team notes. For now, however, the team says clay artifacts, including lamps, are helping to date the discoveries made this year. It's the kind of jumble that you would expect to find in a ruined household following a raid or battle, Gibson said. Household objects, lamps, broken bits from pottery which have been overturned and shattered, and arrowheads and a piece of jewellery which might have been lost and buried in the destruction. Frankly, jewellery is a rare find at conflict sites because it is exactly the sort of thing that attackers will loot and later melt down. If the discovery really is what it's thought to be, the researchers say it was direct evidence of scenes detailed in the Hebrew Bible. I like to think that we are excavating inside one of the great man's houses mentioned in the second book of Kings 25:9, Gibson speculated. This spot would have been of ideal location, situated as it is close to the western summit of the city, with a good view overlooking Solomon's Temple and Mount Moriah to the northeast. We have high expectations of finding more of the Iron Age city in future seasons of work. The biblical significance of this discovery is researchers from the University of North Carolina, Charlotte, say they found evidence of the Babylonian conquest at Mount Zion from 587 to 586. The team points specifically to the passages 25:1-2 from the second book of Kings. This, as cited by the university, states, "So the city was besieged unto the 11th year of King Zedekiah. On the 9th day of the 4th month the famine was sore in the city, so that there was no bread for the people of the land. Then a breach was made in the city, and all the men of war fled by night by the way of the gate between the two walls. And he, Nebuzaradan, the Babylonian captain of the guard, burnt the house of the Lord and the king's house, and all the houses of Jerusalem, even every great man's house, burnt he with fire." In the UK, newlywed couples could be branded criminals within days of their wedding if they fail to follow a new system for registering marriages, the Archbishop of Canterbury's Marriage Licensing Office has said. Under the system, which could be enforced by the end of the year, couples will no longer be given a marriage certificate at the end of the service. Instead of being asked to sign a register and a certificate during the ceremony, they will instead sign a single marriage schedule or marriage document. It will then be their responsibility to take this document to their local register office for their marriage to be recorded in an electronic register before being given the certificate. Newlyweds who fail to do this within a set time will be legally compelled to attend personally, the new law states. Those who fail to do so will be guilty of a criminal offence and could face a fine of £1,000. The Government's General Register Office, the GRO, is yet to confirm the timescale, but a Church of England body has said it understands that couples will have only 7 days. The Reverend Marcus Walker, a rector from London, said, "Thanks to the new rules, newly married couples have an immediate threat of criminal sanction laid upon them. Great." The Faculty Office, which issues special marriage licences on behalf of the Archbishop of Canterbury, said that the church has only months to train more than 20,000 clergy in the new system. It said, "The significant difference is that the couples will need to ensure that the marriage document is deposited at the local register office within 7 days of the date of the wedding. The couple can ask someone to lodge the marriage document on their behalf, as in many cases they will, of course, be on honeymoon. But it is their responsibility, not the officiating minister's responsibility, to ensure that that is done." The office posted on Twitter, "There will be criminal penalties for failing to register a marriage in the same way as there are for failing to register the birth of a child or a death. The changes have been made under the Civil Partnerships, Marriages and Deaths Registration Act 2019, bundled with moves to make space for mothers' names on marriage certificates and allow opposite sex couples to form civil partnerships." The Reverend Paul Butler, a rector from South London, said, "This is going to create all kinds of chaos. A simple revision of the marriage registers and certificates to include mothers' details would have sufficed." The Reverend Dr. Marek Brown, the Church's Director of Public Affairs, said he wanted to reassure priests and couples that the GRO would provide training for clerics. He added, "We are in close discussions with the GRO, who are working hard to ensure that the change is as smooth and seamless as possible." The Home Office said that it had not confirmed an implementation date and could not confirm the 7-day deadline for registering a marriage. A spokesman said, "The Act will mean mothers are equally represented on their child's marriage certificate. It will also modernise the way marriages are registered, moving away from the outdated paper-based system and saving over £30 million. A 400-year-old temple in Japan is attempting to hotwire interest in Buddhism with robotic priests it believes will change the face of the religion, despite critics comparing the android to Frankenstein's monster. The android Canon, with a K, based on the Buddhist deity of mercy, preaches sermons at the Kodachi Temple in Kyoto, and its human colleagues predict that with artificial intelligence, it could one day acquire unlimited wisdom. "This robot will never die, it will just keep updating itself and evolving," priest Tensho Goto told AFP. "That's the beauty of a robot, it can store knowledge forever and limitlessly. With AI, we hope it will grow in wisdom to help people overcome even the most difficult troubles. It's changing Buddhism," added Goto. The adult-sized robot began service earlier this year and is able to move its torso, arms and head, but only its hands, face and shoulders are covered in silicone to replicate human skin. Clasping its hands together in prayer and speaking in soothing tones, the rest of the droid's mechanical parts are clearly visible. Wiring and blinking lights fill the cranial cavity of its open-top head and snake around its gender-neutral aluminium body. A tiny video camera installed in the left eye completes an eerie, cyborg-like frame seemingly lifted straight out of a dystopian Hollywood sci-fi thriller. Developed at a cost of almost $1 million in a joint project between the Zen Temple and renowned robotics professor Hiroshi Ishiguro at Osaka University, the humanoid called Mindar teaches about compassion and the dangers of desire, anger and ego. "You cling to a sense of selfish ego," it warns worshippers. "Worldly desires are nothing more than a mind lost at sea." With religion's influence on daily life flatlining in Japan, Goto hopes Kadaji's robot priest will be able to reach younger generations in a way traditional monks can't. Young people probably think a temple is a place for funerals or weddings, he said, trying to explain the disconnect with religion. It might be difficult to relate to fuddy-duddy priests like me, but hopefully the robot is a fun way to bridge that gap. We want people to see the robot and think about the essence of Buddhism. Goto insisted, however, that Mindar was no gimmick to boost income from tourists. This robot teaches us ways to overcome pain, he said. It is here to save anyone who needs help. The pious droid delivers sermons from the Heart Sutras in Japanese, with translations in English and Chinese projected onto a screen for foreign visitors. The goal of Buddhism is to ease suffering, said Goto. Modern society brings other kinds of stress, but the goal hasn't really changed for over 2,000 years. A recent Osaka University survey showed a wide range of feedback from those who have seen the android at work, with many expressing surprise at how human it looked. I felt a warmth you wouldn't feel from a regular machine, said one of those polled. At first, it felt a little unnatural, but the android was easy to follow, replied another temple goer. It made me think deeply about right and wrong. Others were less convinced, some insisting the robot was too fake. The sermon felt uncomfortable, complained one worshipper. The robot's expressions felt too engineered. Kadaji Temple has also faced criticism, mostly from foreigners, for tampering with the sanctity of religion. Westerners have been the most upset by the robot, said Goto, noting largely positive feedback from Japanese visitors. It could be the influence of the Bible, but Westerners have compared it to Frankenstein's monster, he added. Japanese people don't possess any prejudices against robots. We were brought up on comics where robots are our friends. Westerners think differently. The Gutenberg Bible, says Margaret Leslie Davis, unequivocally, is a masterpiece of world culture, the most beautiful work of printing the world has ever known. Only 49 copies are known now to exist, and one edition held by the Morgan Library and Museum in New York, when put on display, is surrounded by armed guards with drawn revolvers. The Bibles were made in 1456 by Johannes Gutenberg in Mainz, Germany, for distribution to churches, convents and monasteries. Hitherto, sacred texts were painstakingly copied by scribes, a process that took years. Gutenberg's innovation was to create a mechanical typeface that resembled traditional monkish calligraphy, and a Bible could be assembled in a few weeks. The single alphabetical letters, cut from metal, were combined and recombined by hand to make an ever-changing stream of words. The lines of words, punctuation marks and spaces were slotted and held in wooden frames, and the blocks of text were then inked and pressed onto the paper, or vellum, which was first moistened, the better to hold the pigment. The printing press was developed from an olive press, and the printer had to be able to arrange the type upside down and backwards in columns of equal width. Those of us who had a John Ball printing set as children will know the basic drill. It was an advanced technical skill, and to this day the ink of a Gutenberg Bible shimmers as if the pages were just recently printed, we are assured. The leaves are as black, as glossy, as the hair of a Japanese beauty. The original binding was of calf skin, stretched over the wooden boards. The margins of the Royal Folio pages, 16 inches tall by 12 inches wide, were decorated with elaborate, richly coloured illuminations, coils of flowers, animals and birds. Copies began to appear on the open market after the French Revolution upended the religious establishments, a process exacerbated by the chaos of war caused by Napoleon. The first private owner of the Gutenberg Bible, whose fate is the one followed in Davis's study, was the Earl of Gosford, who paid £45 for it in 1836. English aristocrats saw books as trophies and status symbols. There was a fashion for fancy hand-tooled bindings, coloured leather that looks good on the shelf. Gosford, a moody recluse, shipped thousands of rare volumes to his castle in Northern Ireland. His Gutenberg was placed in a library so cavernous that it required two men and a 40-foot ladder to reach the top shelves. Gosford died aged 57 from an attack of gout in the head, and his son and heir, who was interested in the estate only for grouse shooting, liquidated the library in 1884 to cover his gambling debts. The Bible was sold for £500 and went to Didlington Hall, Norfolk, the palatial home of Lord William Tyson Amherst, who possessed a bottomless hunger for the best of the world has to offer. The hall, set in a 7,000-acre park, had ballrooms, 46 bedrooms, a suite for visiting royalty, and a museum filled with antiquities. The Bible was kept in a steel casket inside a fireproof vault. It was, for Amherst, an unmatched bargain. Then disaster struck. The family solicitor, having embezzled Amherst's fortune, killed himself. At least £250,000, about £30 million today, had been lost, and in 1908, the Gutenberg, along with everything else that had been collected, had to be sold off to make good the fraud. The Bible went for £2,050. 6 weeks later, Amherst dropped dead from shock and grief. The book was then purchased by Charles William Dyson Perrins of the Leon Perrins Worcester Source Empire and displayed in his country house near Malvern. Perrins also owned the Royal Worcester Porcelain Factory, which, unlike the condiment concern, kept losing money. In the post-war period, to keep the china works going and to pay the wages of a large staff, Perrins was forced to sell his library for a total of £147,627. On March 11th, 1947, the Gutenberg was auctioned off yet again, this time for £22,000. The new owner, Sir Philip Beaumont Freer, a private collector, sold it almost immediately for a £3,000 profit to Estelle Donaghy, a widow whose late husband had left her oil wells worth $1.8 billion in today's figures. The Gutenberg Bible went by ship to America, disguised in a crate marked Commodes. Estelle, who enjoyed amassing prayer books and other sacred texts, was overjoyed. The moment I saw the book in its wonderfully perfect condition, I felt as if I wanted to lift it up and kiss it. It is a sad irony that Estelle had advanced glaucoma and could never actually read any of it. She had wanted her own copy of the Gutenberg Bible since 1911 and was always outbid, hence Davis's title, which refers to the way Estelle always lost her chance. Finally, in October 1950, the book, probably the finest copy known, with no pages missing or defaced, arrived in Los Angeles, having been hastily inspected by New York customs officials. The Bible was kept in a hidden room, away from dust, dirt, smoke, or soot. Estelle died in 1958, and her treasures were left at the Edward Lawrence Donaghy Memorial Library at the St. John's Seminary in California. Against what would have been her express wishes, however, and in a clear violation of the spirit of Estelle's bequest, the library was closed down and everything dispersed in a sale in 1987. A new corporate regime at the seminary saw the Gutenberg and other manuscripts and even the paintings on the walls as inert assets. There was absolutely no interest in or understanding of the enlightened idea that art is what lifts our gaze towards God. Stupidity and philistinism prevailed, as it so often does. The committee now in charge wanted only to maximise revenue for the church, and the funds raised were used to redecorate the Archbishop's quarters. St. John's Seminary now resembles a motorway service station, apparently. The Gutenberg Bible was sold to a company in Tokyo for $5.4 million. A high-resolution photographic version was made and placed online. The original has been secured in an air-conditioned vault in total darkness, with all access to it denied. Scholars, no matter how qualified, will never see it again, unless something radical happens, which, as we have seen, has always been the pattern with the book in the past. In Victoria, Australia, priests will risk being sent to jail if they don't report child abuse revealed to them during the sacrament of confession under new laws being introduced. The bill, introduced in Parliament this week, would make religious ministers mandatory reporters of abuse suspicions alongside police, teachers, medical practitioners, and early childhood workers. I don't think in contemporary and mainstream times, knowing what we know now, that we can do anything other than say the rights of children trump anyone's religious views, Attorney General Jill Hennessy told reporters. Ultimately, this is about making sure that we start to right the wrongs of systemic abuse. Under the laws, priests and spiritual leaders face up to 3 years jail if they don't report child physical and sexual abuse allegations. I would expect anyone who is aware of a commission of a crime would have the wherewithal and the personal ethics to report that crime, Ms. Hennessy said. The Andrews Labour government's reforms will also allow survivors of institutional abuse to apply to the Supreme Court to overturn unfair compensation settlements previously signed with churches. Chrissy Foster, who with her late husband fought for years for compensation for their two girls who were abused by a Catholic priest, said there is no excuse for priests who fail to report confessions of abuse. A Catholic priest will try to get away with a basement bargain deal with all of this. They should pay until they can't stand up, Ms. Foster said. But the Catholic Church has insisted priests will be obliged to defy the laws. In the Catholic Church, the seal of confession is the absolute duty of priests not to disclose anything that they learn from penitents during the sacrament of penance or confession. In a pastoral letter issued last year when the laws were flagged, Melbourne Archbishop Peter Comensoli, who was strongly committed to reporting to the appropriate authorities, but I am also strongly committed to upholding the seal of confession. In the same bill, anyone denied a working with children check for serious crimes such as rape and murder would no longer be able to appeal that refusal. Victoria's Liberal National Opposition has previously indicated it would back a law mandating priests report child abuse allegations. And finally, a man with a huge grin approaches a priest. Bless me, Father, for I have sinned, he says. I spent the week with 7 beautiful women. Do not fret, my son, says the priest. All you need to do is to take 7 lemons, squeeze the juice into a glass, and drink the juice. Will that cleanse my sin from me? No, but it will wipe that stupid smile off your face.
My name is Paul Hill. Thank you for listening to Lutheran Radio UK. Lutheran Radio News will be back next Friday. Until then, every blessing to you and goodbye for now.